Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name is David DeGroote. I'm the president of the San Francisco chapter of the Federalist Society. And you've come to our panel on internet search, antitrust, and speech. This is brought to you by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, as well as the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, as well as our own chapter. My job is to welcome you, thank you for coming, and also to introduce very briefly our moderator, who comes to us from the Ninth Circuit and who also sacrificed his ninth row World Series tickets tonight. That is the Honorable Carlos Bea. He normally has a somewhat more cheerful appearance than he made this evening. I'll try not to put any baseball references into my introduction, but Judge Bea was, before he began his judicial career, he himself was a sports star. He was at the Helsinki Olympics playing basketball for the Cuban Olympic team. He eventually made his home in San Francisco. After working at a firm, he struck out on his own in private practice and then found a place on the bench in 1989, right around the time of the 1989 World Series earthquake, I think, and was on the San Francisco Superior Court before getting onto the Ninth Circuit in 2003. So without further ado, I give you Judge Carlos Bea.
Thank you, David, and we won't say anything more about those tickets. Tonight's presentation and discussion is explained in the program you have before you, but what it really boils down to, from what I get, is Google in the crosshairs of the regulators? If the discussion is going to be about how internet search engines are affected by antitrust and to what extent should not be affected under the First Amendment. We have a couple of outstanding persons to talk to you tonight, and I'd like to introduce them briefly to you. First, we have Ronald Cass, who's the president of Cass and Associates, a legal consultancy firm in Great Falls, Virginia. Ron has been, among other things, a dean emeritus at Boston University Law School, where he served as dean from 1990 to 2004, and then as a professor, or at the same time as a professor of law there. He's the author of more than 100 scholarly books and articles. His commentaries have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, the Boston Globe, Forbes, and Real Clear Politics. He has taught at several universities, including two in France, and one, the Francisco Marroquín University in Guatemala. He is the chairman of the Federalist Society Practice Group on International Law and National Security, and chairman-elect of the Administrative Law Group. Just to show how broad are his connections, he also serves as the Policy and Governmental Affairs Officer of the American Bar Association International Law Section. He received his BA with high distinction from the University of Virginia in 1970, and is a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, where he received his JD with honors in 1973. Also with us tonight is Thomas Barnett of Covington & Burling. He's a partner in the Washington, D.C. office and co-chair of the firm's Antitrust and Consumer Law Practice Group. He specializes in global antitrust and competition law practice and works closely with the firm's white-collar practice on criminal antitrust enforcement and investigative matters. Tom recently served as Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Antitrust Division. He headed the Antitrust Division from 2005 to 2008, having previously served in the division as Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Civil Enforcement. He was involved in some of the largest and most complicated criminal matters in the division's history, including investigations and prosecutions that involved coordination with multiple competition authorities in other jurisdictions. He argued before the Supreme Court as amicus on behalf of the United States in a case which we in the federal courts run across practically every day, a very important case called Bell Atlantic Corporation versus Twomley, and he's testified several times before congressional committees. Among his other honors, Tom has received the Edmund Randolph Award from the U.S. Department of Justice for his highest honor for his service in the division. So without further ado, we'll go to the speakers tonight. They will each speak to you for about 15 to 20 minutes. Then we'll have dialogue between the two of them. Then we'll take some questions from the audience. Unlike certain moderators, which have been seen in certain debates recently, I shall not attempt to determine the result. Ron?
And the videographers asked me if you can just check your cell phones to make sure they're off or on vibrate. That would be great. Thank you.
You want me to check mine then?
That would be also appreciated.
Well, first of all, thank you to the San Francisco chapter of the Federalist Society for having us out here, and thank you, Judge, for getting us started. I want to know that if I see people in the audience doing the wave, I'll recognize this has nothing to do with the remarks and a lot to do with the score. One of my friends had been with a group of fellow colleagues walking along the beach in Santa Monica, and one of them had stumbled across an object in the sand. He reached down, picked it up, dusted it off, and sure enough, it was an old lamp. And he rubbed it, and a genie, of course, came out of the lamp. This was a California genie, so he said, under the rules we follow here, you only get one wish. But you have three options. You can choose either great beauty, great wealth, or great knowledge. My friend thought for a moment and said, I'll take great knowledge. The genie went zap, disappeared, and the other friend stood around waiting for what would come out of his mouth now. Was it the next E equals MC squared? Was it some great insight to what would happen with the markets? And after a few minutes, my friend thought and said, I should have taken the wealth. Obviously, in life, it's always difficult to make the right choice. It's a little bit difficult to see the future. Yogi Berra had it right that it's more and more difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. But what we're engaged in tonight is talking about a process where really what is involved is making predictions about the future. We heard the other night that a lot of things in life change, that we don't have bayonets or horses the way we used to, that we have things called aircraft carriers and submarines now. In almost every area of life, things tend to change, and things also tend to move in directions that aren't easy to foresee. When I started teaching, I taught a variety of subjects, including intellectual property, administrative law, antitrust, administrative law which deals with the industrial regulation, antitrust, and international trade. These all used to be separate fields. Those of you who practice law may realize they are today all merging. They're becoming one field because the developments in business and in law are pushing them increasingly together. The same is true in the economy. We see changes that look like areas that were once separate now are coming together. There was a time when the typewriter, I don't know if anyone else, I see one of you there, Larry is the other person who's old enough to remember this. When I learned to type on a standard Royal typewriter. You know, you banged on it to get the keys to work, then you reached up, you got them unstuck, you hit the carriage return, and then when you made mistakes, you pulled the paper out and started over. When I started practicing law in the early 1970s, I had two secretaries because 90% of what we were doing required typing and proofing. Back in 1970, a third of all women who worked outside the house worked as secretaries in the United States. We've had a sea change in all of that. When IBM in the 1960s introduced the Selectric typewriter, within a period of about 5 years, it had half the market for electric typewriters. Within less than 10 years, it had three quarters of the market. And electric typewriters between 1961 and 1965 went from 10% to 50% of the market for typewriters. Now, if you had told someone back in the 1960s or even in the early 1970s that at one point we'd be using computers to do word processing, they would have viewed that as akin, one person described it as akin to telling someone you were going to take a jet fighter down the street to go to the shopping mall. It was such a huge change from what anyone thought. But of course, we went from having typewriters to electric typewriters to word processors by companies like Wang to having portable computers that did the word processing for us. We went from having companies like WordPro and SSI dominating the field to having Microsoft dominate the field for word processing. And now we see tablets evolving. We see a lot of people who are using their phones to do this. If you told someone that cell phones and cameras would be part of the same market, because we'd have something called smartphones, there are now 1 billion smartphone users on the planet. And these are things that started out as cell phones, but now double as cameras, and as personal assistants, and date books, and they're what keeps your phone contacts. They do a lot of things that used to be in separate markets. This is the nature of change. As you move forward, things that looked like they were in separate markets become part of the same market, because in a dynamic economy, things evolve, and people take on, they have businesses that take on functions that they think can be performed better by some other device, some other technology. We live in a very innovative age. We live in an age when IP-intensive industries account for about a quarter of the workforce and between 35 and 40% of GDP. They're growing at a rate 1.5 to 2 times the rate of the rest of the economy. It's an incredible thing where innovation and technology change, take on new fields, take on new identities, and compete with products that seem to be in different arenas. Now, antitrust, which is supposed to prevent the worst sort of interferences with competition in the market, has a wonderful job to do when it does it right. But when it looks at single firm contact, what one individual business does, and says, we want to stop you because you're too dominant, you're doing things that are going to interfere with competition in your market, antitrust takes on a role, which is a very dangerous role for antitrust to play. Now, Tom knows this, having been in the business of doing this. I've been both a regulator when I worked for the, when I was a commissioner at the federal, at the International Trade Commission. I've been an advisor to the Justice Department, the FTC. I know these people have a difficult job to do, and I don't want to really pick on them too much. But I do have to say that when the antitrust division or the FTC has ventured into the territory of finding a single firm that it thought was dominating a market and ought to be restrained, it has time and again made mistakes. It has overemphasized the degree to which the dominant firm would continue to dominate the market. It has underappreciated where competition would come from, how quickly it would come, and what it would do. And let me just mention a few cases that are major cases that the Justice Department or FTC brought or were on the verge of bringing that illustrate this. One case that everyone knows is the IBM case. This was brought in 1969 against IBM on the theory that IBM's mainframe would forever dominate the computing market. There really was no source of constraint on IBM. And the government poured a huge amount of resources into this, as did IBM, which fought this case for more than a decade and consumed an enormous amount of not only the resources of the company, but also the time and energy of the executives of the company. And one of the things they missed was what was happening in the market for personal computers. They were in the market, but they were not in the way they would have been if they hadn't been quite so distracted. And of course, after the case had gone on for a very long time, Bill Baxter, when he took over as the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust, dismissed the case voluntarily because he realized it had been a mistake in the beginning and there was no way to avoid the recognition that personal computers and mini computers and other computers had taken over functions that were once reserved for mainframes. There was competition coming. It had arrived in ways that hadn't been predicted, and IBM was no longer the dominant force it was thought to be. At about the same time, the government prepared twice cases against General Motors for dominating the auto industry. Between about 1940 and 1970, GM accounted for 40 to 50% of the U.S. car market. The big three automakers accounted for between 80 and 90% of the car market. And both the Justice Department and the FTC at different times thought this was a case that needed to be brought to break up GM. Of course, as we can see, that happened essentially on its own. One of the theories behind the case was that foreign cars, imports, would never be a real force in the U.S. market. Between 1945 and 1955, imports accounted for 1% of the U.S. car market. Between 55 and 65, about 6% of the U.S. car market. But it exploded, and by 1980, it was a quarter of the U.S. car market. Today, it's over half of the U.S. car market that's either imports or foreign labels made in the U.S. The competition arrived in a way that the regulators didn't foresee, and it arrived faster and more powerfully than they thought it would. The Microsoft case, another famous case, was brought against Microsoft for dominating not just the market for operating systems, but for wanting to extend its reach into areas like browsers. Even though it was quite clear there were many browsers available in the market, you could switch freely. They were priced at zero. No one was being hurt by this, but the antitrust authorities thought that there was something really nefarious going on, and they used a theory which was then a very popular theory called raising rivals' costs to come after Microsoft for doing things that disadvantaged competitors on the theory that this also somehow would disadvantage consumers. I think time showed that Microsoft really was not so dominant as it seemed to be, and it was certainly not permanently dominant, because companies like Google were coming along behind it using the internet as a way to compete with personal computers. So that the dominance in the computer world that was attributed to Microsoft was not something that was permanent, long-lasting, or doing harm to consumers. AT&T is another case that was brought by the government and prosecuted for a very long time. AT&T was broken up, and within a very short time, it essentially was reconfigured in its old shape and then bought. The central AT&T was bought by one of the old pieces of AT&T. What happened there was that the government thought that landline telephony was going to permanently dominate the telephone world. They didn't see what was going to happen with cellular telephony. You know, today there are many people who don't have landlines at all, and certainly cellular telephones compete with landlines in a way that wasn't foreseen at the time. I'm not in this trying to criticize the regulators for not being able to foresee these changes. They're hard to foresee. I'm criticizing them, however, for thinking they could see what was going to happen. When we look today at Google and the internet and search, and the Google case is merely one of the many cases being talked about in the high technology area, we see areas in which entry is free, where the products are priced freely. Consumers are charged nothing. Companies come and go. When Google got into the market for search, it was dominated by Yahoo. There were 8 or 10 other companies that were in there before Google that were doing search very well, thank you, but not as well as it turned out Google was going to do it. And when people use the verb Google, they're paying tribute to the fact that Google came up with a better algorithm, a better way of doing things, a way that for a while in some share of the market dominates a certain type of search, but there are plenty of others out there. Amazon and Yahoo and eBay, all do search. Facebook is talking about doing a search, a general search feature of its own, but people do searches on Facebook. They do searches on travel sites. They do searches on Barnes & Noble for books. They do searches for specialized queries. They do searches when they look for products. There are all sorts of searches that are being done. And of course, internet searches are just one part of a more general search market. To think that we know how it's going to evolve, I think, is to give ourselves greater powers of prediction than I, or I think anyone at the Department of Justice or FTC actually has. When Facebook went public with its IPO, there are a lot of smart people who knew just what it was worth. This was a $100 billion plus company, which 4 months later was a $50 billion company. Because it turned out that when the IPO went public, people started asking, well, how are they going to make money? How are they going to keep out competitors? What's going to happen in this market? Here's a company with 1 billion users. There are 1 billion people who now use Facebook. The question is, does that mean they can dominate the market in a way that does something that harms consumers, that reduces output, raises prices, harms someone in a way that's meaningful, that we ought to have the government invest its money and our money in combating? When the government does that, it distracts one company. It harms one company. It holds back one company. It intervenes in the market in a way that has consequences for competition, and it gives a disincentive to people to invest heavily in their own network, in their own particular sort of business. Now, one of the things that is said these days is that network industries, industries where if everybody's doing the same thing, you get extra value from it, are special and different. That's also what was said in the Microsoft case, and it's also what was said in the GM case the government was preparing, because the dealerships and the service parts of the business were thought to be a special sort of network that gave durable power. All of these things are things that change over time, that evolve in ways that reduce the power of the incumbent and that let people in. And the businesses we're looking at today are particularly functions of this. One last comment before I wrap up, and that is that we're also dealing with an area where if we want to regulate a search firm by telling it what it should have on its site, how it should list things, how it should do its algorithm, what it should tell people, we're talking about things that have a free speech component as well as a business component. We ought to be very careful about that. Let me end with one quick story. Many of you know the film True Grit, and there were two women who were talking about it, one blonde, one brunette. I know this from my wife, who's a brunette. And the brunette said to the blonde, I will bet you $50 that John Wayne falls off his horse. And of course, the blonde knew better than that, so she took the bet. They went and saw the movie together. And afterwards, the blonde gave the brunette $50 because she said, I was shocked that he fell off his horse. Brunette said, I can't take your money because I saw the film before and I knew he would fall off the horse. Blonde said, I saw the film before too, but I just didn't think he'd do it again. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's always an honor and a pleasure to participate in Federalist Society events because the discussion is uniformly at a high level and stimulating, and I'm happy to be part of it. I am particularly honored, although I will say saddened, to question the judgment of a U.S. Court of Appeals judge in appearing at the event this evening, but I will just look at the positive and say that it is indeed an honor to be here and very much appreciate your sacrifice. So I'm going to talk about two levels. I'm going to talk about the big picture, which I will parenthetically mention is, with all due respect, most of what Ron talked about. And then I'm going to talk about facts. There was a lot less that you heard about specific facts to the specific cases that are at issue here. From the big picture, I think Ron presents sort of a false choice or a false dichotomy. He's painting a picture that, you know, in general I agree with, that antitrust has a role to play. It's a limited role. If you are not careful about how you apply antitrust enforcement, particularly in unilateral conduct cases, you can do more harm than good. That's absolutely true. But what is not true is that you should repeal Section 2 of the Sherman Act, that you should have no antitrust enforcement, that there is never a time that the government should intervene, that you should let the markets work on their own regardless. That's not the law, and it shouldn't be the law. What you heard were a number of statements like, well, they weren't a permanent monopoly. Well, in the long run, as Keynes said, we're all dead. That's true. But in the short and intermediate run, there's a lot that can happen that's very important. So I think there is a role for antitrust to play. I think it's one of the things I said when I was in the department. It is a very difficult and a hard challenge, but a necessary one to undertake. And the reason I say it's a false dichotomy, because the choice isn't really, in many instances, between should there be antitrust enforcement in these particular cases or should there be a free market. The choice may well be should there be antitrust enforcement or should we create a brand new federal agency or empower an existing federal agency to come in and take over and regulate in a very direct, burdensome, and inefficient way. And I think, you know, a little stepping back and looking at history a little bit is telling in that respect. You can look at the antitrust laws as an enabler of deregulation. When they were talking about deregulating the airlines, the trucking industry, the railroad industry, one of the key arguments that was made was the antitrust laws are there as a backstop to ensure that competition will remain. You don't need the regulation. And this isn't just a historical debate. I mean, one of my more vivid memories of being in the department was learning that, and I won't go into too much detail, but you know, a large investment firm on Wall Street named Bear Stearns needed to merge, you know, in the next, say, 12 to 24 hours, or Wall Street was going to melt down and the world financial markets might come to an end. And, I mean, you all know what happened. The point there isn't whether there was an antitrust problem. The point was that we've gone through a period of time where faith in the markets, faith in their ability to operate, I do believe they are the greatest engines of innovation and growth, and they are, in general, the best way to organize an economy. But faith in the markets was greatly shaken. And we spent time, in a way that some people might find surprising, but it was actually reassuring in some ways. I would go to conferences in Europe and talk about, well, it's very clear that the U.S. model of free markets is dead. It's been proven wrong. Now the only question is, you know, how far into the economy should the government get? And the one voice that was standing up was the European Commission. I mean, Neelie Kroes stood up and said, no, hold on a second. Competition is a good thing. You shouldn't go too far. My point here is the debate is not just free markets versus antitrust intervention. It's free markets versus regulation. And to now transition towards the more specific context here, there are proposals that are out there that, you know, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission should be given the authority to just directly regulate everything that's going on. Then we won't have to be worried about whether or not Google has violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act or Section 5 of the FTC Act. But I want to be very clear about this. I'm not saying you should bring an action merely to forestall greater regulation. I am reacting to the big picture level that suggests markets change eventually, no matter how much harm is done in the interim, and they can be dynamic. But I'm pointing out that where you've done a careful analysis, where you've identified a specific problem, and where you have a remedy to address that problem, antitrust laws can and should be enforced, and that can benefit competition and consumers. So let me talk a little bit about the specifics of the Google situation. And I don't, the judge gave a very fine introduction. I'm not sure he specifically mentioned, but I want to be clear. I do represent clients who have an interest in this. And listen to me, not because of my incentives, but hopefully for the persuasiveness of what I have to say. Under Section 2 of the Sherman Act, it's a violation to monopolize or maintain a monopoly through any improper means. So the two elements are monopoly maintenance, acquisition of monopoly, and an improper means that significantly contributes to one of those two things. You have here a company that I think is, by all reasonable standards, indisputably dominant within at least a couple of relevant markets. One is search, and something I didn't hear Ron mention at all, search advertising that generates, I don't know, $35, $40 billion a year in revenue. It is a very lucrative engine. And those two things are very, very closely intertwined. Google makes $30 or $40 billion a year in paid search advertising because it does have a dominant search engine. And if you want to advertise in paid search, that's really the place to go. Nobody else can generate the relevance and the return on the advertising because of the scale that Google has developed. And however they got there, the fact that they're there now, it makes it very difficult to unseat them. Are they there permanently? Is it impossible that in the next 100 years, the next 50 years, or even the next 20 years, somebody else will come unseat them? That's certainly possible. But the antitrust laws are also concerned with what happens over the next few years. And this is very important. If you have a dominant company who is systematically identifying threats to its dominance and taking them out, that change which might otherwise have occurred, that threat that might have developed and ultimately overtaken them, may not happen. So coming back to the specifics of it, you have a company who's dominant. You have a company who is expanding its activity into these what we call vertical areas. I assume most people know what I'm talking about in that respect. Things like maps, finance, shopping, now travel search, particularly relevant to my client Expedia. How has Google done that? Well, they've done it through a variety of means, but there are two ways that I'm going to focus on that I would suggest that are improper. The first of which is Google, a long time ago and very consistently for many years, said, we have a search engine and we're going to distinguish ourselves from what some other people were doing at the time. We're going to give you search results that are displayed based on our algorithm, which is designed to give you the sites that are most likely to answer your query. We're not going to intermix advertisements in there. We're not going to put links in there because we've been paid or we have an economic interest to put it there. We're going to try and give you the best search results that we have based on our judgment. So for a long time, that, as far as I can tell, was true. They had the search results, and then you had the advertisements that were labeled. There was a different color, and they were in a certain spot on the page. But then Google started inserting a different kind of link. And it was a link to Google's own product, whether it was places or maps or finance or shopping. It was not a result of their algorithm. It was, in fact, a hard-coded link to a Google product. It wasn't labeled as an ad. Wasn't disclosed that Google had an economic interest in getting people to click on that. And obviously, many, many people clicked on it. By failing to disclose to consumers what they were doing, they deceived consumers into clicking on what they think is supposed to be the most relevant search result. When, and we can go into it if you want, there are examples that make very clear the things that Google is hard coding up there by Google's own algorithm are not as desirable for users for that query as other competing products. The other thing that they did, and I'll use the example of Google Places, one of the things that Places was trying to do was to develop content. about places, restaurants, hotels, locations, that sort of thing. One of the things that draws users to a place like that or a site like that are user reviews. And Google started taking, scraping user reviews from other sites, and you're probably aware of this, Yelp, TripAdvisor are two companies who've talked about it. And they started putting those, significant excerpts of those, into the places pages. And when those companies came to them and said, hold on, this is our content, we don't want it on your place's site, which we think competes with this, Google said, fine, just stop us from crawling your site. Of course, you'll never appear on our dominant search engine results, but that's your problem, not ours. I think the coercive scraping and use of content over the objection of the site owners, the deception of users in order to steer traffic to Google's own site is an improper action or a set of improper actions. So you have a dominant company who is moving into these verticals, and now there are a lot of there are people who make a lot of different allegations, but let's just focus on one. Google perceives that these specialized vertical search engines, if you want to call them, can be a threat. They're not a general search engine, they're not a direct threat today. But in the aggregate and over time, they can develop, they can take traffic away from Google, they can form a platform to expand into a more general threat. And by undermining them, they systematically reinforce their dominance in search and search advertising. You now have a dominant company who's used improper means to reinforce their dominant position, a Section 2 violation. And there are remedies to fix that. First of all, you don't deceive consumers. You put your own sites through your own algorithm, so if they're going to appear at the top of the page, it's because your algorithm has legitimately put them at the top of the page. If they're going to use content from other sites to put them in their own products, you get permission to do it. And as a final point here, and then I'm going to stop because I'd rather have more of an exchange, but I wanted to tee up some things. And Ron, I assume there's enough there for you to tee up on some things. None of what I've talked about so far really implicates a serious First Amendment problem. It's black letter law that deceptive conduct is not protected by the First Amendment. And further, it is abundantly clear that the First Amendment does not immunize a company from antitrust scrutiny. And there are certainly cases that talk expressly about the fact that if you're going to monopolize a market through conduct that involves, even involves speech, that can still violate the antitrust laws consistent with the First Amendment. So with that, I will mention, I think I've covered the key points, and so I'll turn it back over to the judge. Thank you.
Well, I noticed that Ron was taking notes, and he might have a question or two of Tom.
Well, I might have a couple of different
things. I
want to, let me just run through a few. One is, you know, I think Tom and I agree generally on the nature of antitrust law. I think it's a little bit of a slick characterization to say that there ought to be a heavy burden to get over is tantamount to repealing Section 2, no rule for antitrust, never enforced. I think the real question is what the presumption ought to be, what the burden ought to be to get over the hurdle to satisfy that there should be a serious Section 2 case. The second thing is the notion that we're talking about either an immediate change or permanent harm, something that doesn't happen for a century. We're really talking about the typical case is that markets actually evolve fairly quickly. They do change fairly fast. You look at the cell phone market, it evolved fairly quickly. The smartphone market's evolving fairly quickly. We see tablets coming in fairly quickly. In the high-tech area, particularly in the internet area, change is driven constantly, and all the companies in the space really are competing very hard and changing what they do constantly. The notion we're dealing with regulation as opposed to antitrust, of course, people will make the argument that antitrust is a backup that prevents you from having to regulate, but of course antitrust is regulatory. I don't think anybody who's been an antitrust regulator would say it doesn't involve sort of the same government powers, the same intrusion into markets, or some of the same risks in terms of having companies lobby for and against it as other regulation. The examples you used of airline trucking deregulation were, of course, areas where there were essentially cartels that were run through the government. And the question is, if you had the same cartels forming outside of government direct regulation, was there some way of attacking the cartel? Here we're talking about single firms and actually attacking one competitor in the competitive market. The harm to consumers, really most of what you were describing was harm to competitors. Now, consumers can switch freely. If they think that a site is giving them bad information, they can switch to another site. Most people use many different search sites. They don't just use one, and they're not locked in. There's nothing that prevents people, if they think a site isn't giving them the right information, from using another site. And so to the extent that there's information that suggests that what Google is presenting to its customers is bad information, people can get that information out in the market. They can make it clear, and of course consumers can judge a lot of this on their own. Consumers generally don't care whether they're getting information that is selected because someone has paid to have it there or no one's paid to have it there. If it's useful information, they go back and they do this on a repeat basis. You know, most people I know these days are constantly using searches to do things. There really isn't any harm to consumers. Last point, and I've got others, but I'll save them for later on, is the notion of deceptive speech versus the First Amendment. You know, if you prove that there is a false advertisement, that a false claim is being made, say, by a drug company about its drug, that its drug cures cancer when in fact it doesn't, that certainly is regulable without in violating the First Amendment. But when you're talking about a company selecting what it wants, like an editorial judgment of a newspaper, what it wants to be where in a list of terms, how it's going to present it so that people see it, what it's going to select in different orders, that's much closer to core speech concerns the First Amendment protects. And I think it's going to be difficult to work through and see what it is that could be addressed here without affecting First Amendment values. I think that, you know, obviously the real question is what the default should be, how high the burden should be, what regulators should have to know before they proceed down the path of a Section 2 case. I'm suggesting that in the high-tech area particularly, and in an area like the Internet, which is an open area where people are given an awful lot for free, it ought to be a very high burden, because it'd be hard to get a remedy that doesn't encourage rent-seeking, encourage competitors to come in and complain, discourage investment, and ultimately hurt consumers.
Well, I guess the reason I characterized the way I did is you throw out the general proposition should be a high burden, you know, they eventually things change, that sort of thing. Can you give me an example where you think that there would be a sufficiently concrete harm and proof that the government should intervene?
Well, I mean, I can certainly say that the cases, the principal cases the government has taken on, were cases where they really didn't appreciate how quickly things would change.
I'm not talking about historically. You can make up the facts, but give me an example that you would say this meets the burden, and you will have disproved my suggestion that you're trying to effectively repeal the Sherman Act.
It's not repealing it to say that you need to come forward with something that shows the harm. You know, if you can give me a case of clear harm, I'm happy to listen. I'm happy to hear a case where the markets aren't going to correct it, and there ought to be something. Most of the cases that were brought historically were cases where there was essentially some form of collusion going on, as well as one company becoming dominant. You had companies that were merging into a single firm to dominate the market, and a lot of what was being attacked was that. It wasn't a company that had innovated its way into leadership that was really the issue that people were concerned about.
So if I could prove to you that in 4 years there was going to be a radical change and this dominant company was going to face massive competition, but in the meantime it was going to extract, you know, $3 billion in monopoly rents, but I could intervene and eliminate 2 years of that and bring competition in 2 years earlier. Is 4 years long, too short a time? Is it long enough?
Well, rather than playing the game of naming the years, of course, when you talk about a time period like that, you're probably talking about a time period that by the time the government gets the case up and going and prosecuted and through the courts, it's over. You know, the case will not be decided until after the market has changed. In the meantime, really what you ought to be focusing on is not this case. It's the type 1 versus type 2 error. Are you having more false positives than false negatives? And this is an area where we've seen one after another false positive. Can you give me an area, you know, can you give me an example of a false negative here? There's a case that should have been brought that wasn't brought in this area, and there was a problem with the market as a result.
Sure, Google's case should have been brought a year or two ago. But I will note that with respect, I mean, you didn't. I gave him a specific, and he, you know, 2 years, 4 years, whatever, I'm not going to answer that. My point is, wherever I am, the bar is higher than that. That's why, in my view, and it's my opinion, which is protected,
by the First Amendment.
That what you're doing is effectively putting the bar too high. No, I understand that. Two other quick points. On you know, the people can switch. Well, switch to what? You've got to recognize that from the advertiser's perspective, they don't have control. They want these eyeballs, and vast majority of them are on Google. And that's where the money is. That's where the harm is, and Google's extracting, and continuing to extract, and reinforcing its ability to extract monopoly rents and paid search advertising has very real cost on consumers. They're the ones who ultimately pay that cost. But when you say, okay, if we give somewhat inferior results, people can switch. You have to realize that, you know, in a competitive market, a competitor needs to charge a competitive price. If I become a monopolist, I don't have to charge a competitive price. I can raise my price by some extent, and people won't switch because I'm a monopolist. It's actually competition in a different vector, if you will, not on price, but on quality. Google can degrade the quality of its product to some extent in order to serve a, if you will, monopolistic purpose without people necessarily switching, because that's the exercise of its dominant power. And that's a point that I've not heard responded to. And then the other point I'll make is, in terms of the deception, the point here is not so much that, you know, the government comes in and tells Google, this is what you have to do. The government is coming in and saying, this is what you've told people you are doing. We're going to make sure that you do what you told them you were doing. That's holding Google to its own standard, which I think is very different. And that's why, you know, the FTC brings, you know, hundreds, I haven't counted up, but certainly many, many cases against companies that engage in deceptive practices without any there being any serious question, but that's consistent with the First Amendment.
Well, just two quick things, and I know we should get the audience in. First is, when you talk about raising prices as a monopolist, you know, I use Google, I use other search engines, I get them all for free. I'm not worried about the prices. And when you talk about advertising, there's a big market for advertising. It's not, advertisers don't have to put their dollars in any one particular medium. They can spread them, and they do spread them, across a whole variety of media, and they compare the benefit they'll get from each one. You know, there are people, Facebook's now carrying certain types of ads on mobile devices. There are a lot of different places you can put your advertising dollars. But as a consumer, I'm not being hurt by getting a product for free. Now, you talk about the deception, you know, as if this were a false advertising case. I actually have never understood how Google ranks things, or any other search engine ranks things. As dean of a law school for 14 years, I used to do with U.S. News a ranking of law schools. And the great thing is, I actually understood how they did that ranking. When you understand it, you realize the way U.S. News does it is it changes its algorithm every year. It makes it so that the smaller the actual difference among law schools on any margin, the bigger a difference it makes to the ranking. It's like having everybody standing in a line and all of you but one take a step backward. That has a huge impact on the rankings. But I don't understand the way any search engine does its rankings. I think I'm too old to figure it out. But I actually don't think I also need to know, and I kind of doubt that's what's going on. I think the competitors of Google who are bringing the pressure on the government to bring this case, or the competitors of other companies that have been asking for regulation of other cases, I think they're probably not thinking about this in terms of what the consumer does or doesn't want. I think it's more in terms of how it affects the competition.
I have a question of both panelists before we go any further and into the audience. I would like your views as to what is the difference between the regulatory thrust that we find with the Federal Trade Commission here in this country and the European Union's different methods of regulating Google.
Are you talking about the methods or the
goals, how they see the economics of Google differently, if they do?
Well, I mean, Tom may have a different view on this. My sense is that Europe has been less sensitive to economics than the U.S. FTC, DOJ, and courts have been, and that they have been much more willing to talk about harm to competitors than the U.S. is, even if that's what drives a lot of the action and a lot of the complaints, a lot of the concerns.
I think that historically I would agree with Ron, but there has been an evolution, and I give particular credit to Mario Monti and Philip Lowe, who in the early 2000s instituted a number of changes within DG Competition, one of which was to bring in a chief economist and to bring in an empower an economic staff. And you've actually seen, convergence in terms of the analysis and results. This wasn't long after GE Honeywell, where it was this obvious divergence. And you've not seen anything as dramatic as that since. That doesn't mean they always agree, but there's better communication and the analysis tends to be closer. Now, having said that, I think, my own perception is that the Europeans in general come from a different legal culture and background where they are more used to and accustomed to government intervention in the marketplace. They have, relative to the U.S. government agencies, probably more faith in their ability to do good. And more fear about what the markets may do on their own. And I think the substantive law tends to reflect that because the standard to intervene in a unilateral conduct case, I think, is lower under European law than it is under U.S. law.
Okay. Dave, you've got the microphone. Let's open the floor for questions. And
so if you're seated on this side, I'll reach over to you. And if you're not, then come on over and I'll get to you. So the first question.
Thank you.
Please state who you are and for whom is the question.
That's David Emerson, and it's really a toss-up for everyone who wants to take it. It's a fascinating subject, and I think it provokes a number of interesting questions, one of which I think harkens back to the cases which were described, the GM case, IBM, AT&T, and Microsoft. And what's a little bit different about Google, in fact, I would argue a lot different about Google, is that instead of just a two-party transaction, provider-customer, we got the advertising component as well, is really providing the money for the engine. Now, in the case of being able to switch freely, computers wear out, cars wear out, even phone numbers are portable. But one of the fascinating things, and I would almost say nefarious things about Google, is that it's amassing an enormous database. We're not aware of this, but it exists. And it creates not just a barrier to entry, but an increasingly high barrier to entry for every bit of data that's put into that. And at some point, the stickiness of Google becomes the stuck of Google. So how, looking at that aspect of it, it's a different animal than these others, how would antitrust in your model respond to that?
Well, I'm happy to jump in on that because I think that was more coming from your side than mine. The argument that this is different is an argument that was made with respect to IBM and AT&T and GM, and each time this is different. Actually, you see the market changing now. You see Google's share of search in different areas going down. You see its ability to get searches on mobile devices not the same as on PCs. You see an awful lot of new specialized search engines coming up. You see Facebook, which has a lot of material that isn't penetrable from the outside, coming up with its own search engine and its own way of searching sites that it has particular access to. So I think, in fact, far from being special in the sense of keeping entrants out in a durable way that we haven't seen before, Google is much more vulnerable than a lot of these other dominant firms were. And again, if you look at what happens in markets, you know, Facebook, let me use that as an example. When Facebook went public, an awful lot of people said, you know, I see they have 1 billion users and they're dominating the market for social networks. How do we know that others won't come in with other special things that will take away a lot of what they're doing? And maybe it doesn't have to be one. It can be a whole bunch of different ones that do that. So I don't have the same sense you do that Google is special in that way and especially scary in that way.
Tom?
Shockingly, I disagree. and on this one, again, I actually don't think this is a particularly close case in that it is very clear. Google continues to amass massive amounts of data. And part of the reason their search engine works so well, their advertising works so well, is because of the sheer volume that they have, that they generate. And if you look at, you know, like some of the documents that have come out in some of the various litigation that's gone on, you see this great focus within Google about data. It's data. We can use the data. It is a barrier to entry, and I think you described it well. And I will admit, Ron, I'm a bit puzzled when you talk about Google's shares going down and in mobile. If you look at search, I mean, you know, you can debate about Bing in the United States. You know, one of the differences between the U.S. and Europe is, in Europe, Google's share is like 90-95%. There is literally nobody else. And if you look at mobile search, and I understand Ron's about to argue that apps are a substitute for search, but if you look at mobile search in the United States, Google's got like a 90-95% share. It's even higher than it is on desktop search. So I don't think you see any evidence that their dominance is eroding, at least any time in the foreseeable future.
If I can just jump in one.
Sure.
I don't want this to be exactly like the presidential debate.
Do I look like Candy Crowley?
I told you can play Candy Crowley, correct, Tom, anytime you want. It's if you're defining... I'm not an expert on Google and its market share, but if you're defining the market to give them, you know, 90-something percent dominance, what you're doing is you're excluding Apple, you're excluding Siri, you're excluding all sorts of queries. You know, it's a very peculiar definition. There was, you know, when there was a case brought against Microsoft, it was essentially a case that where they narrowed the focus, and as you know well, to the sort of computers that Microsoft dominated. The case that was brought against Intel was for dominating a sort of chips in a market they dominate. You can always narrow the market. The thrust of the remarks I was making at the outset is that regulators, and whether it's antitrust regulators or other regulators, typically view the market in a very narrow term that excludes an awful lot of what's going on around it. And it's not what will go on in 100 years. It's what's going on now. It'll just bear fruit faster than they expect.
If I can just very quickly point out, it's interesting you're citing Apple as a competitor to search. If you do a search on Apple, you know who powered that search. It wasn't Apple. It's Google.
Next question.
I guess my question mostly harkens back.
Who are you?
Bill Goodwin.
Notice he had to look down his name.
Had to do his visual search. I'm gonna,
David will make sure you got that right.
My question mostly harkens back to something that was mentioned in the previous question, but a personal anecdote first. In my own experience, I've entirely excluded using Google on mobile, mostly because of the ineffectiveness of their results, so I use Yelp exclusively for local place listings and so on and so forth. That being said, I do think that there was something in the other question that I didn't hear entirely answered. I was hoping to get both panelists' feedback, which was, who is the consumer that's being harmed by virtue of Google's dominance? Because there is this interesting paradigm where you have the advertisers that are essentially the users of Google, because they're the ones who are paying money. But you have the consumers who are the obvious, or the users in the popular sense, who are using it for searches, who are also the users. But it seems like the people who are most being hurt are the competitors, as opposed to either of those two main users. That being said, I do think that there's a lot of other points to be argued. So I'm just trying to, if we could hone in on that briefly, I would be interested to hear.
Who are the consumers being hurt?
There are two ways that consumers are being hurt. One is through the advertising. I say that the advertisers pay it up front, but that is a clear cost that gets passed through to consumers. So at the end of the day, if Google's earning X billion in monopoly rents, you can rest assured that consumers are ultimately paying that. But the other harm, which is harder to quantify but is probably more serious and fundamental, has to do with the effect of innovation on the internet. The internet is an amazing engine and petri dish of development, and the ability of somebody to come up with a Yelp or a TripAdvisor or somebody like that can bring tremendous benefits. But when you've got an environment where the ability to become noticed on the dominant search engine is now skewed and it becomes much more difficult to be discovered, you are less likely to have innovation. Now, that's the dog that didn't bark, so I can't point you to X that didn't happen. But at the end of the day, innovation is what drives most of the economic growth in our society, and so we should be very concerned about that.
Well, just two quick points on this. First is when Tom says that the advertisers are facing higher costs. They're paying monopoly costs, and those are costs that get passed on to consumers. First, I don't have any reason to think they're paying monopoly costs to prices, because search is part of a larger advertising market. There are lots of ways advertisers get their brands out in front of consumers, and it's a highly competitive market for advertising. But the second thing on the advertising is that advertising, in part, is getting information about products out to consumers to lower the cost for consumers to find what they want. And a lot of economists who have studied this have said that, in fact, advertising is not simply an add-on to the price of a product. It's something that can dramatically lower the cost of getting products and customers matched well in ways that reduce the prices to everybody. And the second point is that when you talk about the consumers as the people being harmed and what happens and whether people can switch, whether there really are barriers to entry here, there's no shortage of innovation in the internet space. There's no shortage of new startups in the internet space. There's no shortage of new ideas in the internet space. And while you're right in a sense, it's hard to prove the negative here, it's also hard for me to see that there is some real impediment to people getting new internet startups going. I haven't seen that.
If I can just, I'm glad you brought me back to the advertising market point. I had forgotten to mention that. Again, facts are important things. They can even be stubborn things. The fact is, if you talk to advertisers, you talk to advertising agencies, do you trade off the cost of a Google paid search ad versus an advertisement on the local television station or radio or newspaper or whatever, to the extent that newspapers are able to advertise anymore? But and the answer to that is no. they're different kinds of advertising. It's not all one big advertising market. And once you drill down on it under very traditional antitrust principles, you find that Google or paid search advertising is its own relevant market. And given Google's share and its earnings, I understand that we can respectfully disagree, but I don't think, I personally am pretty certain that there's a fair amount of economic rents that Google is enjoying.
Michael?
Well, I have a question for Tom. You seem to me to be making an assumption that because advertising is a cost of doing business, that can automatically get passed on to the advertiser's customers. I wonder why you make that assumption, because, you know, any cost of doing business, you know, like advertising, cannot necessarily be passed on to somebody's customers. It depends upon who the advertiser is and who they compete with in their marketplace, doesn't it? As to what they can get away with passing on.
Sure, but in the longer run, if you have certainly a variable cost like advertising, which it typically is, if that doesn't get passed through, the markets are going to equilibrate to the point where it is passed through. Is it passed through a dollar for dollar? It may not be. There are various models where part of it may not be passed through, but even, you know, in a perfectly competitive market, you would expect all of it to get passed through. Frankly, it's in the less competitive markets where you would think that the models would suggest only part of it gets passed through, but part of it still gets passed through. So can I draw you a line between this dollar and this increase in price? No, I'm not suggesting I can do that. But I'm suggesting that, the economic theory and the studies that I've seen say that in general you can expect that if you add on a cost like that, at least some portion of it is going to get passed through.
Ray Tittman, Carol Burdick and McDonough. Just want to ask if anyone has a score of the Giants game. Just kidding. I got a real question. I'd be curious to hear that what is, and if so, what is the distinction between what Apple is doing to Google and what Google is here alleged to be doing to Expedia, right? My Google Maps was deleted from my iPhone recently by Apple, and if we advocate for an open market, is that any different than what's being charged against Google?
I assume that's directed at me. Well, the most obvious distinction is whether or not Apple is dominant within a particular relevant market. And while Apple is a very popular product and they have a very significant share of smartphones, in fact, Google has a significantly higher share of smartphone shipments, at least not Google, Android-based phones that Google controls. So if you're not a dominant company, the antitrust laws, and I agree with Ron on this quite appropriately, generally don't intervene in unilateral conduct in that regard.
But that does put the point that you have to be very careful in how you define what market someone's dominant in. The game in antitrust always is to get the narrowest possible market to increase the dominance, whereas people who are looking at it from the other side may see a much broader a set of things. You know, things aren't always as obvious as they seem. I'm reminded of the two blondes who were sitting outside their house in Washington who looked up at the sky, and one said to the other, "Which do you think is closer, the moon or Florida?" To which the other blonde turned to her and said, "Hello, can you see Florida?" You know, sometimes we think we know what's going on, and a lot else is really happening there.
Hi, Declan McCullough from CNET. You mentioned correctly that Android has a higher market share, but I covered Apple's CEO Cook's presentation yesterday in San Jose, and he said that 95% of tablet internet usage is done with an iPad. So can we then say that maybe your answer should be different if we're talking about tablets? Is 95% enough?
Now I'll come back. I will at this point say I don't know the answer to that because I haven't gone in to sort of analyze what I think is necessarily the relevant market. It depends factually. If you're a dominant company and you start to engage in exclusionary behavior, that can be a problem. But if so.
Any other questions?
Yeah, a question for Tom. What would the restrictions on Google look like if antitrust authorities can establish their case, and what are the kind of restrictions that Google would be looking at, and what kind of effect would that have? Obviously, there could be many, but maybe two or three that come to mind.
Sure. What comes to mind is that Google would be restricted from, displaying results in a way that are misleading or deceptive. And a way to accomplish that is to ensure that, if it's an ad, it's clearly labeled as an ad. And if it's a search result, it goes through their algorithm and isn't, hard-coded and put up in this sort of third category that they never explain. Is one way that you can address that sort of issue. On the use of scraped content from other sites for their own products, you can require them to get permission to do that. Those are a couple of examples that you could consider.
It does sound to me like an ongoing regulatory program once you start down that path. And we see in Europe what they've done with Microsoft is kind of an ongoing regulatory program. We had some more evidence of that today in the news. It's very tough to have one of these that is clean, surgical, and doesn't involve ongoing intervention, particularly if you have to keep justifying how you display your results, and you have to keep disclosing to someone what the algorithm is. I love our government, I think it does wonderful things, I'm not sure it always protects information the way it should. And I think we would be on pretty tricky ground going down that route.
Let's be careful what you ask for here, because when you talk about clean surgical remedies, there are clean surgical remedies that involve, cutting, severing, separating parts of the company so that the company that's got the dominance engine doesn't have the incentive to favor its vertical products. Yeah. I'm not saying that's necessarily what's called for here. I'm just saying be careful. Because if there's a behavioral remedy, if there's a problem and there's not a behavioral remedy that fixes it, then the agencies are going to start thinking about, what should we do rather than doing nothing.
I haven't gotten to the problem yet.
Yes.
I'm still. This is one of those things where every once in a while we have a solution in search for a problem. I haven't found the problem yet we're solving.
Yeah. Well, I will make the observation, and we're having a good, I hope, somewhat spirited debate, and that's good. But in reality, when you look at what's going on out there, I think we are actually at the point of what's going to happen. I mean, what's the remedy going to be, as opposed to whether there should be a remedy. Commissioner Almunia has gone out and publicly stated, I found four areas that I think are a problem. And it's, he seems very serious about pursuing that. So while it doesn't change anything you just said, I'm just observing in the real world, that seems to be where we are right now.
Just in terms of where things stand, what do you see happening in the next year or so in terms of enforcement activity? Obviously, the election may have a role in that, but what are the things that you see on the immediate horizon that are actually happening with the FTC?
Well, my own personal view is I don't think the election is likely to have much an effect one way or the other. The FTC has been looking at this for a long time, and ultimately you all can read the reports as well as I, but I think. I get the sense that they are trying to, the chairman's been express about this, they're trying to reach some sort of determination by the end of the calendar year, and my sense is that is exactly what they're trying to do, and I give them credit for it in that You know, things do move quickly. That doesn't mean dominant companies necessarily get displaced. But, you know, litigating against IBM for 8 or 10 years isn't necessarily good for anyone. And that's another point Ron and I can probably agree upon. So trying to do an investigation reasonably promptly and trying to reach a decision reasonably quickly, I applaud them for that. I think that's good government, regardless of, you know, what they ultimately do.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up. Bill Goodwin, definitely. I confirmed it. I have no incentive at all to defend Google in this case or work up the street at a firm that is less than happy with Google in a lot of ways. But the I think there's two quick questions. One is per your rent-seeking point. I noticed that Google's cost per click, as they reported in their most recent earnings, continues to decline. So it seemed like by at least some, you know, very simple measures, advertising costs are actually decreasing for advertisers. And that may just be an unsophisticated understanding on my part. So it's maybe I'd like to understand a little bit more about where the rent seeking is coming from. And then a somewhat unrelated question, which is, isn't there a qualitative difference between something like, you know, taking Yelp reviews and repurposing them in your search results versus categorizing types of sites and using their data, but not necessarily reserving their data in the same way? So I guess this is more a question to the left side of the panel than the right, but the is there a
decision? I definitely think
that
is the left side of the panel.
I was going to say.
From my perspective,
it's all a matter
of
perspective, exactly. Well, to be honest with you, I haven't seen the most recent Google data or earnings data, so I'm not really in a position to comment on it. I mean, my general understanding is they're still earning very healthy returns. You know, that may go up or down a little bit, but that's consistent with there being durable market power, monopoly power. On your, and I'm sorry, the second point, which I've now lost track of, you don't have to repeat the whole thing, but.
Just, is there a qualitative difference between taking someone's reviews entirely versus just using the information on their site to categorize a site?
I do think, and if I follow you correctly, I think it's a very important distinction because, you know, Google has long crawled sites and collected enough information so they could put a search result up there so that people could determine, okay, this seems to be a site that I want to click on and go to. And then that site gets the benefit of that visit. When they start taking more of that content and actually serving it up so that the user doesn't have to go to the site to get the benefit of that content, I do think that that is a significant difference.
One thing on this, and this will be, I think, a last point for me, and that is when we talk about durable monopoly power, one thing to keep in mind is that the government has the ultimate durable monopoly power. When we look at individual companies that are being investigated, being brought under the eye of government, and potentially threatened with very serious consequences, there's an awful lot of pressure. Even if you have behaved in a perfectly competitive way in a market that's highly competitive, that's serving consumer interests, there's a lot of pressure on companies to try to reach agreement with regulators to avoid being dragged out through a long time, distracted from your business, threatened with potentially very serious fines. And any company that's been through this, as Tom knows, is looking not just at whether they've done anything wrong, but how much pain the government can inflict. And I think we ought to have rules in place that do keep the government within fairly strict lines to make sure that it is not doing things at the behest of certain competitors that disadvantage others, threaten to impose costs, and really disrupt the market in that way.
Any other questions?
Oh. Lindsay Bauer. I've got a loaded comment and a question. The loaded comment is, when I think of switching costs and information asymmetries, that brings to mind Eastman Kodak, and we all know how that's doing. And the question has to do with barriers to entry. I'm wondering if you could address barriers to entry from a sort of a Stiglerian perspective. It seems to me that where the firm in question has some sort of advantages that other firms can't reproduce, and I would imagine that if Google just went into standstill mode and Yelp or whatever were free to hire away its chief technocrats, Yelp could make great strides? To address that question.
The fact that there are barriers to entry doesn't mean that the company doesn't keep working. Indeed, Google is working very feverishly to collect more data to reinforce those barriers and indeed to identify and undermine threats. So, you know, it's not necessarily being complacent, if you will. I don't think it would be hard to disagree with the notion that if they sat back and did nothing, that would make it easier for somebody to catch up with them. But part of the problem is, in terms of barriers, as I understand it, if you or I got the same algorithm that Google started with and we started trying to use it today, we'd never catch them. We'd never come close to catching them because it's this continual learning process and it's a brilliant innovation. I give them full credit for that. But they are so far ahead, and they keep going doing that they maintain their dominance. And the fact that they keep doing that, as I say, doesn't eliminate it, or eliminate the fact that there are barriers to entry, and that gives them the ability to earn, super competitive profits in their paid search advertising, for as long as that's maintained.
From a Chicago perspective, there are no barriers to entry. From a Stiglerian perspective, there's nothing here. You don't have to have huge investment and plan to get into this business. There's no exclusion of people from this market. This is one where, and in fact, as Tom said, it was a brilliant innovation that made this company successful, but there were already leaders in the market who had a big advantage and were way ahead. And if you look at this in terms of the leader, obviously, being someone no one can catch, they wouldn't have passed Yahoo in a period of 6 or 7 years, whatever it took to do it. So I view from Stigler's standpoint, this is one of the last places you'd want to have an intervention.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that'll be the last word. I want to thank you all for coming this evening. If you're baseball fans and Giants fans, your work in coming here is, I think, going to be rewarded. Again, if you're not part of our chapter and want to be, send an email to sffederalist@gmail.com, and your MCLA materials are outside. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good job.
Thank you very much.